This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks, Kev. Turn to James. Turn to James chapter 1. Yeah, we're in the New Testament today, at least for the first minute. Because in James chapter 1, we're going to read a verse or two, and this is what we're going to witness in our story today. James chapter 1, verse 14. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. David is one of the leading characters in the Bible. And when it comes to what people remember most about David, there are two incidents which come to mind. First, many Christians are taught as children about David and Goliath, David the giant killer. But secondly, since children in general are not of a maturity to understand what adultery is all about in the commonly accepted sense of the word, this second famous incident about David is generally passed over in Sunday school lessons for children, and rightfully so. In our serial studies of the lives of Saul and David, we now come to this blackest blot in the life of David. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11. The title of this two-part message is David and Bathsheba. Thus far in our examination of the life of David, we have seen great contrasts between his character and that of Saul. David, up until this point, has, for the most part, exemplified the good, the noble, the meritorious, the virtuous, the honorable, the commendable, and the praiseworthy traits of character, with very few clear instances of bad character qualities. But with today's study of David and Bathsheba, though, that all changes. We will find a man who succumbs to temptation, to the lust of the flesh, and who then compounds the sin with dire consequences. And yes, David is a type of the overcomers. He is the preeminent type of Christ. But many of the character qualities exhibited in today's story are about as far from Christ-like character as one can get. For we find in today's text David's fall into adultery and then into lying, deceit, and murder to cover up that initial sin. And in so doing, David manifests wickedness, some of which we never found in Saul. We've reiterated the statement in many of the previous messages in these studies to the effect that David is one of our best role models for those aspiring to be overcomers. And it should go without saying, but I will say it just for the record, let no one ever think that just because David sinned in this manner and that he was an overcomer, that this fact in any way legitimizes or gives the green light to an aspiring overcomer to follow this same path. Let's now commence the story. 2 Samuel 11, 1. And it came to pass, after the year was expired, at the time when the kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still at Jerusalem. We read this verse as we closed our last message entitled The Wars of David. Here we note that the nation had now become unified and powerful enough to the point that David no longer had to personally lead the troops into battle. He stayed back at the capital and only came out to the battlefield when about all that remained was the formal surrender ceremony of the enemy, as we'll see towards the end of today's story. Verse 2. And it came to pass in an eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. We remember that back in 2 Samuel 5, verse 9, just after David had captured from the Jebusites the high stronghold of what was later called Zion, or even the city of David, that David built there what I would call a subdivision around his own house. In other words, the houses were probably like we find in many suburban subdivisions today, right here in Atlanta. You know, in that one homeowner's exterior bedroom wall is only about 20 feet from the neighbor's exterior living room or kitchen wall, right? These big $500,000 houses with about 10 feet a yard between them.
Yeah, really.
In the city of David, all the roofs were flat, and they served as patios and as additional living space, as well as very pleasant places to sleep or take a nap in the hot summer months. And as was customary in those semi-tropical regions, many of the people did take siestas in the heat of the day and arose somewhere in the mid to late afternoon and did the other half of the day's work when it was beginning to cool down. So that was the situation here. David got up from his nap and was walking about on his rooftop, probably enjoying a cool breeze, when he looked down toward his neighbor's house and he noticed this beautiful woman washing herself. There are debates about Bathsheba's relative guilt or innocence in David's initial temptation. Where was the area in which she was bathing? Was it in a garden-type setting, like an exterior patio with lots of trees and bushes and other plants, which would give it a lot of privacy? Privacy except from the top, of course. Or was it in a room like an interior bathing chamber where there was an open window? Was she totally innocent? Or was she careless in not pulling the window curtains closed? Or some have suggested that actually she was conniving and that she deliberately, but not too obviously, exposed herself. After all, the argument goes, living next door to the king, she would have been familiar with the king's habit of taking an afternoon nap, followed by him stretching his legs in a brief walk around the perimeter of his rooftop patio. And it would have been very easy for her to position herself and for her to time it just right so that David would, quote, accidentally see her if she had some kind of enticement in mind. Now, I do not see enough information in the scriptures to judge one way or another on this matter. What we do see is that it speaks of David's sin. That's where the focus is, and so it's pointless to speculate really about Bathsheba's relative guilt or innocence. But David's first and no doubt accidental glimpse of this naked woman led to his lingering gaze upon her. And at that point, it was lust. And it led directly and immediately to David's breaking of the 10th commandment because he coveted his neighbor's wife. Now, some might say, well, technically he didn't know she was not that she was married. But I think otherwise. We'll get to that in a couple more verses. But nonetheless, David did not stop at the mental sin of coveting. He acted upon his desire. Verse 3, and David sent and inquired after the woman, or about the woman. And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Certainly, if he did not know previously, he found out very quickly who she was, and that she was, in fact, married. David was perhaps not all that different from many other Eastern monarchs when it came to women. Kings had harems. If a particular female caught his fancy, he simply took her, and she became one of his wives or concubines, part of his harem. We read this a few messages back, so you don't need to turn there, but listen as I read 2 Samuel 5:13. This was just after David drove out the Jebusites, and it says, and David took him more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem after he was come from Hebron, and there were yet sons and daughters born to David. So evidently David had a harem already. And we've also noted previously the law of God, the law's prohibition against kings multiplying wives unto themselves. This was David's Achilles heel. The area of sexuality was David's area of weakness. David now finds himself caught up in a vortex of lust. He did not care if she was married or not. His illicit desire to have her overrode his desire to obey God's law. Verse 4, "And David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her house." Turn to Leviticus 18. Obviously, keep a marker here. This is our main text for the day. Leviticus 18. Now, the facts in the verse that we just read are straightforward, except for that phrase, "for she was purified from her uncleanness." Why was this fact inserted, and what exactly is it referring to? There are two possibilities here. If we take the word for she was purified, if we take that word for to mean because, in other words, he lay with her because she was purified from her uncleanness, then it would seem to be referring to the law in Leviticus 18, verse 19, which reads in the King James, "Also, thou shalt not approach unto a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is put apart for her uncleanness." A little bit obtuse. To put it in modern English, I think the New International Version is correct here when it gives this rendering. "Do not approach a woman to have sexual relations during the uncleanness of her monthly period." Or the New American Standard, "Also, you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness during her menstrual impurity." I find it very strange that most so-called Bible authorities characterize this and similar laws as ceremonial or ritual, and that they say the woman is ceremonially or ritually unclean. And they follow up by saying that all the ceremonial laws have been done away with. Frankly, I don't see anything ceremonial about this law. To me, it's clearly a law of good hygiene, and God put it in there for our good. It's like the food laws. If we eat things like pork products and shellfish, those things that are unclean and not fit for food, then we will eventually pay the price in terms of, say, arthritis or other debilitating and life-shortening diseases. Likewise, if couples do not abstain from sexual relations during the wife's period, then I believe that the health of both of them will suffer as a result. Maybe not next month, maybe not next year, but like eating unclean animals, it will manifest years down the road. In the first possible explanation, where it said, "for she was purified from her uncleanness," this might be saying that David lay with Bathsheba because she was not on her period. The second possible explanation involves the law found in Leviticus 15. So flip back there a couple of chapters, 15:18. In the phrase, "for she was purified from her uncleanness," it has been suggested that "for" could have been translated "when" or "and." Now hold those meanings in mind as we look at this law in Leviticus 15, verse 18. "The woman also with whom man shall lie with seed of copulation, they shall both bathe themselves in water and be unclean until the even," or the evening. Basically, again, this is just good hygiene. It means that couples should not simply get up and go about other business, but that they should take a shower. So if the meaning of the word "for" is really "and" or "when," it would simply mean that Bathsheba and David had sexual relations, and then she got up and bathed and went home. However, if that is the meaning, do you see the irony or the hypocrisy in that action? It would imply that having just polluted themselves spiritually, having just committed an act of immorality, that nonetheless Bathsheba is very careful to comply with the letter of the law regarding physical uncleanness. But is this not characteristic of sinners even today? That having committed flagrant sins, whatever nature they were, and thereby darkened their souls, that they exert themselves all the more to give the appearance of outward conformity to the law, even to the scrupulous and meticulous observance of the letter of the law. This has been portrayed so often in mafia movies, like The Godfather, for instance, that it's almost become a cliche. You know, where the mafioso guy has just blown away his competition, you know, went to a restaurant where all his enemies were eating and kills them all, and then he goes to Mass, right? So it appears like he's a good Catholic. Well, obviously, some weeks had to have passed before Bathsheba missed her period, and then she was certain she was pregnant, and she informs David, 2 Samuel 11, Verse 5. And the woman conceived and sent and told David and said, I am with child. Now, as you know, the Bible often condenses much activity into one brief statement. This is especially obvious when one reads the book of Jasher and compares those expanded versions of the stories with the biblical accounts. The point is that we do not know for certain whether or not David and Bathsheba carried on their affair for some length of time, or if it was only a one-night stand, as the common parlance has it. I tend to think it was carried on over a period of time, for one, because it appears that David did in fact love Bathsheba. Regardless of whether or not it was a single instance or repeated instances of adultery, God's law is clear on the penalty for such an act. Leviticus 20, verse 10. And the man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. And I guess that the question most of us would have at this point is, why did God, or how could God, let David and Bathsheba, quote, get away with it? We'll come back to that question later. Verse 6. And David sent to Joab, saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. Who was this Uriah fellow? Turn to 2 Samuel 23. First of all, it identifies him as a Hittite. Now, the Hittites were descendants from a guy named Heth, H-E-T-H. And Heth was the second son of Canaan. So Uriah was a Canaanite, evidently of the remnant of those who had not been driven out of the land. But that's not all he was. We read in 2 Samuel 23, verse 1, now these be the last words of David. So we've fast-forwarded to David's deathbed scene, right? And then it goes on for a number of verses with David's deathbed statements. But as we look at verse 8, we must remember that 2 Samuel is not necessarily and always written in chronological order. It's not. Because now comes a listing of David's mighty men, the warriors who had distinguished themselves in battle and in service to David, going back many years to when he was still fleeing from King Saul. And it goes on in what we would call flashback style to relate several stories of the deeds of the mighty men. And in the course of the rest of this chapter, it mentions there were three men superior to the rest, and then there were 30 other men, and then it concludes there were 37 in all. Now, we're not concerned about those particular numbers at this time, but we do want to point out several things in this passage which will help us to become acquainted with several characters who play prominently in our story today and in the stories which lie just ahead. First, look at verse 13. It says, and three of the 30 chief went down. They should have inserted the word men there. Three of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in the harvest time unto the cave of Adullam, and the troop of the Philistines pitched in the valley of Rephaim. I point out that phrase, pitched in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in an hold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. So you recognize this is a flashback story, right? Philistines had a garrison in Bethlehem. And then it goes on to tell how three of David's mighty men valiantly battled into Bethlehem to get a glass of water for David from the well at Bethlehem. And that was his hometown, you recall. As I say, the story's related here, but we're simply pointing out that it connects back to 2 Samuel 5. Now, keep a marker here for a moment. Turn over to 2 Samuel 5, verse 17. Of course, we covered this quite a while ago. And it says, but when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines came up to seek David, and David heard of it and went down to the hold. 18. The Philistines also came and spread themselves, where? In the valley of Rephaim. So by this connection, we are merely establishing the fact that this incident occurred many years before, when David had first become king over both Israel and Judah, and that these mighty men had been with David and were close to David for a long time. And there's only 37 of them. And so back to 2 Samuel 23, and we see in verse 24 that it lists Asahel, the brother of Joab, as one of David's mighty men. Of course, Asahel and Joab were also his nephews. And we recall Azahel. He was the fleet-footed young man, the warrior who chased after General Abner, and Abner had to kill him in self-defense, remember? And then Joab, out of hatred and vengeance, assassinated Abner, if you remember that. And David should have put him to death because it was a murder. But he didn't have the... He couldn't control this Joab guy. Joab had something over on him. Well, as one reads the list of mighty men in 2 Samuel 23, we find that it includes at least two non-Israelites. As we see near the end of the list, in verse 37, it says Zelek the Ammonite. And then Naharai the Beerothite, armor-bearer to Joab, the son of Zeruiah. 38, Ira an Ithrite, Gareb an Ithrite. And 39, Uriah the Hittite. 30 and 7 in all. Now let me ask you a question. Does it not seem reasonable to assume that David not only was vaguely acquainted but with his mighty men, but that he knew them all very, very well? That's a reasonable assumption, isn't it? And so the point is that Uriah the Hittite was not the average, anonymous, rank-and-file soldier who had never met the commander-in-chief. As one of the 37 mighty men who had been with David from way back, Uriah had undoubtedly been in the top ranks of David's army for many years, and they were well acquainted. The point is, or the next point is, I should say, that Bathsheba also was no stranger to David. Look at verse 34, where it says, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. He was one of the mighty men. And earlier, just a few moments ago, we read that Bathsheba was the daughter of who? Eliam. Her dad was one of the 37 mighty men. He was a brother comrade of Uriah the Hittite, and his brother comrade Uriah married Eliam's daughter, and they live right next door to David. Why did David have to go and inquire about the woman? As though he didn't know her. He knew her. He was inquiring about getting her to come over to his house. But now David has Uriah sent back to the palace, and notice David's ruse, his pretense, back to 2 Samuel 11. His deceit. 2 Samuel 11, verse 7. And when Uriah was come unto him, David demanded of him how Joab did, and how the people did, and how the war prospered. Whoa. Wait a minute. Put yourself in Uriah's place. You would wonder, why would the king send for me just to ask me these simple questions, which any regular messenger from the battlefront could have answered? These were superfluous and frivolous questions. You wouldn't call me home just to ask me these questions. What's going on? Uriah is puzzled, but probably not for long, because as he leaves the king's presence, I imagine he's chatting with some of the guards out there and runs into the messengers that had summoned Bathsheba, and they either tell him outright or let it slip that, hey, you know, your wife's kind of been coming over to the palace on a regular basis. I believe Uriah began to get suspicious, which explains his subsequent actions here in the next few verses. Being a loyal, dutiful, gung-ho military man, Uriah had come straight from the battlefield to David's house when he'd been summoned. He had not stopped by his own house first. He had not even cleaned the mud off his boots, so to speak, because in verse 8, David said to Uriah, "Go down to thy house and wash thy feet." And Uriah departed out of the king's house, and there followed him a mess of meat from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and went not down to his house. Now, of course, David's purpose was to have Uriah go home and sleep with Bathsheba, so that everyone, including Uriah, would think that the coming baby was Uriah's. And David, in his efforts to try to get Uriah to sleep with Bathsheba, even had his cooks prepare a very substantial gift of food. But Uriah, now being quite certain why he'd been called home from the front, decided not to cooperate with David's deception. He chose to bunk with the guards, which had separate chambers out at the entrances to the king's house. Now, if David thought he was under stress before, he's now getting extremely uptight when he learns that Uriah did not go home. Verse 10. And when they had told David, saying, Uriah went not down unto his house, David said unto Uriah, Camest thou not from thy journey? Why then didst thou not go down unto thine house? And Uriah said unto David, the ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, meaning the army. And my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go into mine house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? Hello. As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing. It is possible, of course, that Uriah was blissfully ignorant of anything going on between his wife and David. It's possible that simply out of his loyalty and sense of duty to God and country that he made those statements in verse 11. But I doubt it. And we're going to go forward. We're going to expound the rest of the story from the angle that Uriah had learned from the gossipers what the truth was. And so verse 11 was his very clever answer to David's deception. And such an answer would be such that David could think, could read into it that Uriah was unaware of David's treachery. So David's disappointed, but he has another trick up his sleeve to try to get Uriah to sleep with his wife. As we read in verse 12, and David said to Uriah, tarry here today also, and tomorrow, and I will let thee depart. So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him, and he made him drunk. And at even he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but he went not down to his house. You can imagine this scene. David invites Uriah for dinner. They have a drink before dinner. You don't refuse a drink when the king offers. And as they eat their meal together, David begins to reminisce about the days of years gone by. Remember that time when Saul's men were chasing us and we had to scramble up through those rocks and over such and such a mountain? Yeah, yeah. I'll drink to that. Remember when we fought the Philistines a few years ago? And I'll drink to that, you know. David would have waxed eloquent for as long as it took to get Uriah drunk enough to hopefully head back to his wife's bed. But Uriah, even through the haze of the alcohol, had a resolute will in this matter. And perhaps having learned through the gossip about his wife's infidelity, he might have had no desire whatsoever to sleep with her. And so he went out half sloshed. What's the word? Sauced? Schnockered. Whatever. Half drunk. Blitzed. Toasted. Any more? Anyone else? He went out half blitzed and bunked with the boys again, to David's serious disappointment. This is not working, David's thinking. And so all night long, David, being somewhat loosened by the alcohol himself, tossed and turned and hatched in his mind a terrible scheme which his then demented mind told him would solve this problem. Verse 14. And it came to pass in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die. Of course, this was a most cruel twist in itself, to send Uriah's death warrant in the care of Uriah himself. If Uriah was suspicious, why didn't he open the letter? Well, I think it's simply because the kings in those days sealed them with a wax seal. And there's probably some kind of law that you don't open the mail if it's from the king and it's not addressed to you under penalty of death or something like that. Anyhow, on top of all that, Uriah was a loyal soldier. He obeyed orders. But now General Joab is brought into the conspiracy. But at this point, all Joab knows is that somehow Uriah has displeased the king in a really serious way, and the king has very directly ordered his general to make sure that Uriah is killed in a battle. Now, we've noted in previous messages how Joab is both an amoral man and that he has some kind of power over his uncle David, so that David never was quite able to control him totally. While Joab may or may not have been saddened to see the loss of his fellow mighty man, Joab realizes, well, I could turn this to my advantage. He sees that his own part in this conspiracy affords him knowledge of David's crime, which he figures will serve him in good stead at some time in the future. In other words, Joab is thinking of the possibility of using this knowledge as leverage, or to put it simply, blackmail over David. Verse 16, "And it came to pass, when Joab observed the city," this is the city of the Ammonites, Rabbah, "that he assigned Uriah into a place where he knew that the valiant men were." So Joab checked out the city walls and determined where the best warriors of Rabbah were situated, those with the best chance of killing Uriah. Verse 17, "And the men of the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people of the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messengers, saying, When thou hast made an end of telling the matters of the war unto the king, and if so be that the king's wrath arise, and he say unto you, Wherefore approached ye so nigh unto the city when ye did fight? Knew ye not that they would shoot from the wall? Who smote Abimelech the son of Jerubbesheth? Did not a woman cast a piece of millstone upon him from the wall, that he died in Thebez? Why went ye nigh the wall? Then say thou, Thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." Well, this is fairly easy to understand. Joab is expecting that when David hears the news that some good warriors have fallen in addition to Uriah, David will be angry, thinking that Joab made a military blunder, in military judgment in getting so close to the wall. Joab foresees that David may even refer to Israel history in the matter of Abimelech and the millstone, as if to say to Joab, "You idiot, Joab, every Israelite schoolboy knows that you don't get so darn close to the enemy walls that they can fire on you." That reference is to an incident in the book of Judges, where Abimelech, the son of Gideon, approaches right up to the wall of this high tower in a place called Thebez, and he's killed when a woman on the tower takes a piece of millstone and drops it right on his head. Ow, is right, yeah. Judges 9, if you want to read that later. In any event, Joab tells the messenger, "Now listen, if David explodes in anger, just tell him Uriah was killed also." Verse 22, "So the messenger went and came and showed David all that Joab had sent him for. And the messenger said unto David, Surely the men prevailed against us and came out unto us into the field, and we were upon them even unto the entering of the gate. And the shooters shot from off the wall upon thy servants, and some of the king's servants be dead, and thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Then David said unto the messenger, Thus shalt thou say unto Joab, Let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devoureth one as well as another. Make thy battle more strong against the city, and overthrow it, and encourage thou him." David's reply is almost nonchalant, isn't it? As if to say to Joab, "Well, don't get too depressed over the losses. I mean, after all, you know, you just never know who's going to die in the battle, do you? Too bad about our old buddy Uriah." Again, the treachery of David here is nauseating to read, and it certainly was a stench in the nostrils of God. Incidentally, notice that David is therefore responsible not only for Uriah's death, but for the other several warriors that got killed in this staged incident as well, in the foolish approach to the wall. 26. "And when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband," probably for 7 days. That's the typical period of mourning in those days. And I really wonder, do you suppose, I don't know the answer, but do you suppose David ever told Bathsheba over the course of the rest of their lives?
No.
Did he ever tell her about what he had done to Uriah?
No.
How he had arranged for Uriah's death? You don't think so?
Like
think she ever found out through some other means? Huh?
That sounds like a Bill Clinton deal.
Sounds like a Bill Clinton deal? Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's hope for Bill Clinton is what you're saying.
I don't know that I meant that.
I don't mean to impute that.
Verse 27, "And when the morning was past, David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife, and bear him a son." When the morning was past, David, as soon as the 7 days were up, David took her to wife. Well, the young lady is pregnant, and so David took her for his wife just as soon as possible, so that the baby would appear to be legitimate. Oh, yeah, the baby came a little early. He was premature. Right. But the thing that David had done displeased Yahweh. Those are ominous words. And they set the stage for the next chapter. Do you remember how we mentioned that the five giants, Goliath and his four brothers, represent our five senses? Remember that? When David was a youth of only probably 17, he was possessed of such spiritual communion with God, and he had such great faith that he was empowered to confront Goliath the giant and slay him with a stone in the forehead. Now, David is king over all Israel. He's probably in his 50s. He's consolidated power. He's established good government over all Israel. He's achieved a great pinnacle of success in his life, hasn't he? But then comes an even greater test. This is a test of the giants within. Through touch, taste, and sight, smell, and sound, David was attacked spiritually. In this very dark chapter, we have seen David, one of the greatest spiritual giants in the Bible, cut down and mortally wounded by the giants within himself. All the great virtues we have seen displayed in his life until now have been sublimated. He's pushed them out of the way and they've been replaced with the wicked vices of lust, covetousness, adultery, ingratitude, meanness, injustice, murder, deceit, lying, drunkenness, or at least getting somebody drunk, and finally theft. Theft of a wife. Oh, how the mighty have fallen.